sports, politics, life, Buck Roofing presents Kevin Keatsman Has Issues.
All right, it is baseball season, and Ryan LaFever is our guy. We're going to have our first chat with Ryan LaFever coming up in just a couple of moments. As baseball season has arrived, we will have Ryan on from time to time. We'll talk about baseball issues. We're not going to do a lot of day in and day out Royals topics, breaking news, things like that. You know how this works. If you're new to the podcast, you probably didn't hear our Ryan LaFever discussions last year. Sometimes we talk about broadcasting. Sometimes we talk about historical figures in baseball. Sometimes we talk about rules. Sometimes we talk about how the manager's handling the team. We try to keep to issues or people or personalities when we have our discussions, but it's always something interesting with Ryan. We also, from time to time, get into some of the things that Ryan enjoys in his life, not the least of which is his church and his faith. He is a wonderful family man, big family. He's got a big family. And we didn't connect this winter. It was pretty interesting. At the end of the season last year, he said, you know, I really want to have you out to the house. He's got some land out by his house in Greenwood in Missouri. And he said, I'd love to have you out, and we'll get the axe out, and we'll chop up some wood or get the chainsaw out. We'll do some outdoor work. You can come see the horses and just generally speaking, have a good time. And I was like, that'd be great. The one day that he thought we could do it was prior to Christmas, and then I couldn't do it, and then and the spring training started in February, just didn't work out. But he's a great guy, and there's nobody that I'd rather chat with than Ryan LaFever. We used to have dinner every year at spring training. We went to a Prince concert one time at spring training. We went to an Italian restaurant one time in Surprise, Arizona, in one of the retirement communities that we went to dinner. And I'm serious, we met for dinner. Like, I had a show to do. And, you know, he had things to do. They played a game or something that afternoon. It was over. And we went to dinner at like 7 o'clock, got there about 7:15. And the place closed at 8. It was in the retirement community. That was fantastic Italian food. It was really good. But we felt a little hurried. Sometimes when we get together, we talk a lot. A couple of weeks ago, before the season started, we spoke on the phone. And 45 minutes lasted like a second and a half. But we got a lot in common. He's younger than I am, but I just think he's a tremendous broadcaster, and he makes it worthwhile to watch some of the Royals games that are not very entertaining. He's a wonderful human being. He calls my mom on her birthday, and he calls people every day. He has people on a birthday list, and he calls them and says happy birthday or leaves them voicemails. He's just got that thing about him. Ryan's just a great person. He's a great person, and we've always sort of been close from a distance. We don't live close to each other. We couldn't live farther apart in Kansas City, really, by miles and distance, but I feel connected to him in so many ways. So we're going to have a great chat with Ryan coming right up, brought to you by Fry Orthodontics. Dr. Jeremy Fry and Fry Orthodontics are season ticket holders of the Royals. He loves going to baseball games, played collegiate baseball, and, I mean, he just loves the sport. Terrific, terrific orthodontist and businessman. 13 locations in Kansas City. When it's time for someone to get the perfect smile in your family, please consider Fry Orthodontics. Let them know you heard about it on KKHI or Ryan LaFever's segments. Back 9 Development in Kansas City, Lawrence, Topeka, Manhattan. Your custom home builder or developer for commercial properties, even room additions. Back 9 Development can make your dreams come true. If you want to build, Back 9 would love to build with you. You can call TJ. Tell him your idea. Just float it to him. Say, I've got this land or I got this lot. What do you think? Would this work? 785-236-0161. If you want to see the quality of work that Back 9 Development does, it's all on their website, back9development.com. And my buddy Spencer over at the Finch Knife Company, finchknifeco.com. Spring and summer are here. You're going to be fishing. You're going to be at the lake. You're going to be outdoors. You really ought to carry a Finch pocket knife with you. You really should. Keep one in your pocket. You never know what may happen. In this day and age, you may not know ever what's going to happen. You better keep a Finch knife on you. FinchKnifeCo.com. Keep life from getting dull. Dozens of different collections now, all just gorgeous. Mother of pearl handles, wood, bone handles, just fantastic products. FinchKnifeCo.com or go to Shields in Overland Park or the Bullet Hole in Mission. Great stuff there for Spencer and his team at the Finch Knife Company. All right, Ryan LaFever's here. Let's do it. We'll talk a little baseball, broadcasting, the sport, the team, with our boy, Ryan LaFever. Hit it!
The KK Has Issues conversation is presented by Roberts Robinson Chevrolet Buick GMC. Shop, click, drive at robertsrobinson.com.
Well, always great to be joined by Ryan Lefevre, the voice, the face, the Kansas City Royals. The team off to a bit of a slow start, but a lot of interesting changes and things going on with the club, and including the broadcast teams. And it's always fun to check in with our friend Ryan Lefevre. Hello, Rhino. How are you, buddy?
Good, Kevin. Sorry it's taken so long.
Taken so long to what?
To talk.
Oh,
to get
no,
together.
I did like a 10-minute segment on a podcast a couple weeks ago after you and I talked on the phone for 40 minutes. I said, geez, I wish I could have recorded the entire phone call, because that would have been a terrific podcast. We had a good chat, didn't we?
That's the good stuff.
It's all right here. We'll get the good stuff going here. You've got some changes with the broadcast team, and that really is what we talked about that day, was young Jake Eisenberg now joining the Major League staff here with the Royals and working with Denny Matthews, which has got to be a little bit intimidating for him here at the start. There's some similarities to Jake now joining the team and when you joined the broadcast team. So also Mike Sweeney and Jeremy Guthrie have been added, but some changes this year.
Yeah. And this is one of my first major life going full circle, because when I came from Minnesota to the Royals, I was 28 years old. Denny was broadcasting Royals games 2 years before I was born, and he was my dad's age. I mean, Denny and my dad are about 9-10 months apart. And starting as young as I did, I mean, I think I've just always felt young, and whatever our first impression is somewhere, I think just carries for a long time. So I think forever I will feel somewhat new to Kansas City, and I will feel young in the business, just because that's how it all started for me. But here comes Jake. He's 28 years old. My first year as a major league broadcaster was 1995 with the Twins. That's the year he was born. And I'm a little bit younger than his dad is. So how did that happen?
Well, I think he's doing great, man. And I can't imagine how, you know, I don't know how nervous you get when you get into the broadcast or whatever, but just, you know, the whole off season and thinking about it and leading up to it. What was it like for you when you were getting ready to make your Major League Baseball broadcasting debut? I'm sure you had several weeks or months to think about it. What was that like? Was that harder than the actual work itself?
Yeah. You know, thinking back, when I was with the Twins, if I was going to stay there long-term, my in was going to be on radio. The late Herb Carneal was there for over 40 years. And in 95, 96, my first 2 years is when he started to scale back on his travel schedule. Dick Bramer, who's still the television voice in Minnesota, was the television voice there. And I knew I'd get a chance to do some TV games, but my opportunity to be a long-term Twins announcer, I felt, was going to be on radio. So my first few games were on television, and I wasn't as nervous. I'd been with the broadcast team for a while, and I felt very protected by the producers and my analysts and the team. And I prepared. I was, to answer your question, I was probably more nervous preparing, just hoping that I had the right information for the broadcast. But once the TV broadcast started, it was very conversational. But in my second year with the Twins, I was added to the radio broadcast team. And that's where I probably felt more nervous, because I really wanted to do a good job on radio, because I felt like, you know, here's my shot to make a good impression. And by the time I was in my third year with the Twins, I was doing most of the road games. And in my fourth year, which was my last year, I was doing all the road games. So, those were the games that I was most nervous for two reasons, because of the opportunity on radio. And number two, on radio, the fans had all grown up with Herb Carneal. So a lot of them really didn't care that I went to the University of Minnesota and played baseball, and I was part of the television broadcast team. They wanted to hear Herb. And so there was some, fear and trepidation with that, which set me up perfectly for coming to the Royals. And, you know, I tell Jake all the time, you know, the big difference between me and you is that, you know, you come from our organization, having been with Omaha for a couple of years, and he filled in for a couple of games last year. And I said, you know, our fans are excited about you having here. The fans did not want me here. They're listening to you because they want you to do well. They were listening to me because they wanted me to fail. So, But what happened to me in Minnesota was really good preparation for what I had to face in Kansas City after Fred White had been let go.
Yeah, I don't think anybody, you probably felt that way, but I don't think anybody ever wanted you to fail. You know, there's just sometimes when you're following somebody, they just miss that guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I and maybe that was, you know how it goes in this business. I mean, we can get 10 compliments and if one person, you know, rips us to shreds, I mean, that's the one that really hurts the most. So I probably made the mistake of being oversensitive, but being oversensitive, I think helped me because I didn't come in thinking, well, I'm going to show everyone how great I am. I mean, I deferred to Denny. I just wanted to fit in. I really didn't want to do anything to stand out. And I see a lot of that in Jake because I have seen young announcers or even just announcers who have paid their dues in the minor leagues and they get their chance and it's like, okay, I'm going to show the world how great I am. And that almost always backfires, but there's none of that with Jake. I mean, he's gone out of his way. He and I have had some really long heart to heart conversations about, you know, doing the game on television because he's going to do the games on TV when I go over and work with Denny on radio. And he's asked me a lot of questions about working with Denny. And all the questions are good questions because he wants to do a good job. He's really grateful for the opportunity and he wants the fans to enjoy his broadcast.
Man, all I ever wanted to do growing up was, well, I wanted to play baseball first, but it was, you know, I was never going to make the big league. So the next thing after that was my love, my passion for broadcasting. And it was mostly centered around the Royals. And I wanted to somehow cover the Royals or be with the Royals, do something with the Royals. When this happened in my early 20s, I was scared to death to go start covering the team. And then the first few times I went out to the clubhouse and we did some interviews or whatever, it went okay, but it was very intimidating. I want to throw some names at you of the guys that were, I mean, I'll use the term, and they were kind of ball busters, man. You went walking into that clubhouse in those days and it was intimidating. I'm 21 years old, 22. George Brett, Bo Jackson, Kirk Gibson. I mean, I sit here and roll names off of guys that were like, yeah, really big, strong, bold, gruff personalities. I was scared to death, man. All my life, I just wanted to be around it. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so intimidated. I mean, I guess it changes. I think the players today are really, really nice and probably really easy to deal with because they're so used to social media and stuff. But man, my first experience covering Major League Baseball, whoo, I look back at it, I'm like, I can't believe I survived that.
Well, and similar for me. I mean, I don't know if I'd call them ball busters, but they were big figures and intimidating figures to me. But when I first covered the Twins for an all sports radio station, I mean, it was Kirby Puckett and it was Kent Herbeck. And I mean, just guys that had been there for a long time and they'd won a couple of World Series. And I grew up in a clubhouse. I felt very comfortable in a clubhouse following my dad and his coaching and managerial days, but as a, you know, holding a microphone and coming in with a camera or recorder, it's the reception is much different from, oh, hey, there's Jimmy's son, Ryan. Hey, Ryan, how you doing? You know, now you walk into the clubhouse and it's like, oh yeah, I heard of you, but now you've got a microphone in your hand and asking for an interview. And so I remember that exact same feeling being sent to spring training in 1994 in Fort Myers, Florida, and being all excited about it right up until I had to walk into the clubhouse.
You're like, ah. All right. So
yep,
Jake has joined your team and now Mike Sweeney's going to do more. And Jeremy Guthrie, one of the toss backs to 2015 and the Royals teams that were good in 14 and 15 there have joined the broadcast team. What are their roles exactly?
Yeah, this is a great opportunity for those two guys. I can't think of a way to break in the way that they are because they're going to get to try three different roles. And Jeremy's with us right now in Texas and he's working on radio with Jake and Steve Stewart. But on the last homestand, Jeremy did a pregame show with Joel and Monty and he came in with us on the television broadcast. And so this is a great opportunity for them and for us to see where they best fit in, but to do radio, television, and pre and post on television. I mean, that's a lot of experience. Most guys, when they break in, you pick one role and you see how they do. And if they evolve over time, they might try something else, but they're going to get to do all three of those in the first season. And I'll tell you, I mean, I love both of them. Michael and I have been friends since my first year with the Royals. I mean, he was one of my first friends in the Royals organization and just went out of his way to make me feel welcome at a, you know, a very scary part of my life, coming to a new market and new people and replacing a legend. And although I didn't replace him, I was sitting in his chair. And then Jeremy was just a lot of fun during those great years with the Royals, and watching him resurrect his career with the Royals and helping us win a World Series. But I can tell you this, that all that goes out the window if they're not prepared to be good broadcasters. And I think what the biggest shock for a former player when they get in the broadcast booth is that we're not just up there talking about baseball. And, you know, I don't blame them. They spend 6 months a year, and then year on top of year of, you know, going into the clubhouse or whatever, listening to us, and they hear the good points we make and the bad takes that we have and everything in between. And it's very, and then they know us personally. And so it's very easy for them to think, well, I can go sit up there for 3 hours and talk baseball. And they can with their buddies. But when you go in the broadcast booth, you're not talking to your buddies anymore. You have to find a way to communicate in a way that the hardcore baseball fan understands, the moderate fan, and someone who just loves the Royals but knows very little about baseball. I mean, there has to be something that appeals to all three of those audiences. And you have to work at it. I mean, anyone can pop in the booth for a couple of games, and we basically just interview them for 9 innings. Hey, what have you been up to? Or, hey, remember 2015? Or remember this? Or remember that? And after a while, you have to be able to say something about Dylan Coleman when he comes into the game and he walks four guys and he's really struggling with his control, and understand why and explain it in a way where it's relatable to the fans. And so we've had a lot of conversations about that. And I can tell you that both of these guys want to be good at it. They're not just, a celebrity fill in, and they prepare. They've been very open to how to prepare and what are the interesting things to research. And so that's the part that I enjoy the most. I like both of them as human beings, but they already have a very deep respect for what we do and what we try and transmit to the fans.
Well, we'll get to another former Royals pitcher in a moment, because Chris Young is the general manager of the Rangers, which is where you are with the Royals in Texas. But I want to focus on the Royals first and just generally get your thoughts about Matt Quatrero, the new manager here who missed these games with COVID. And I don't know what all the protocols are anymore, but I'm pretty sure that if I was a little bit sick and I was the new manager of the Royals, I wouldn't let them test me for COVID. I think I'd just be sick for a day or two. I'm not sure I would allow. I mean, unless they have to. What a really tough start for him. I mean, you probably think for a long time, as we've just talked about with broadcasters getting their chance, he gets his chance, and then he's out with COVID, and now he's back with the team. This is a rough first couple of weeks for this man.
Yeah, and most frustrating for him is that he never really felt sick. But as he's explained, I think he was exposed to people who had gotten COVID, and his wife got it, and she was sick. And I think his biggest concern was getting on an airplane for 3.5 hours and flying to San Francisco and, you know, getting the whole plane sick. So that was responsible on his part. And it shows that he has some confidence. I mean, I'm like you, I would be scared to death to be tested positive and after, you know, 5 days on the job and the team's not playing well at the time. But I mean, he took it in stride, and it was difficult for him to watch the games on TV and not be part of the decision-making process as the game was being played. He was part of it before the game started. But I think it just speaks to his demeanor. I mean, he's self-deprecating, and everyone was giving him a hard time yesterday that Paul Hoover has more wins than he does. And he just takes it in stride. But I think it was, without getting too dramatic, I mean, we all learn about ourselves and other people when adversity comes. And this was adversity. It was very unique adversity. But by all accounts, he wasn't insecure about it and stressing out about it. It was just that was the situation. And he knew he'd be back. And so he just has a very calm demeanor. He's a good compliment to his coaching staff for young, high energy guys. Every now and then I'll get to know somebody and I feel like I get to know them well. And I know how their personality fits or doesn't fit with the team. And I'll be honest. I mean, I just totally whiffed on Mike Matheny. I mean, I really enjoyed the time that I had with him and learning about the game. And you know, he has five kids and I have four kids and we're the same age and we played against each other in college. And I just really enjoyed my interviews with him before every game and learning about the game and learning about life. And when he was with the Cardinals, I just felt like, I mean, he just looked like a leader when he would go out to the mound and make a pitching change. But you know, he's my age and my kind of guy. And I didn't see the intensity that he had was maybe not affecting some of the players the way the Royals had hoped. So, you know, there was that. And then Matt Quatrero, which is oftentimes it's what happens. You know, I mean, you and I went through Tony Muser became Tony Pena and Tony Pena became Buddy Bell and Buddy Bell became Trey Hillman and Trey Hillman became Ned Yost and Ned Yost became Mike Matheny and Mike Matheny becomes Matt Quatrero. I mean, you're usually going from one extreme to the other when it comes to mentality and personality and all that. So I can tell you though, that Matt Quatrero is, you know, just very laid back, very, very, has a very calming presence and a good balance too of high energy, young coaching staff.
Well, he appears to have a lot of confidence. I don't know the man really, but they're doing some things pretty quickly here that I like what I see. Now, I don't like the one loss record here, but the pitching looks so much better. They're throwing more strikes. Maybe it has to do with the pitching clock, pace of play, something like that. I mean, there could be a lot of things, but I read a quote that he had that they told the pitchers, and his new pitching coach said this to the pitchers very early on. Let's aim down the middle more. That, you know, we're not good enough to put it right down the middle every time. So let's aim down the middle and see if we don't find ourselves throwing a few more strikes on the corners by trying to just then live on the corner and walking a bunch of hitters. So they recognized that very quickly when they got these jobs that the Royals cannot walk as many batters as they did a year ago. They've got to do something better than that. And I think that sort of looks like it's been reflected. The pitching last night, notwithstanding, the pitching has been really surprisingly good. Are you surprised it has been this good? And is that just a symptom of maybe the part of the season, or do you think there's something good happening here?
Well, the throwing down the middle to me, just, you know, on the surface doesn't make sense. But let me back up. So when I was in high school, my dad was the hitting coach for the A's and I'd get to bat boy. And when the A's were in the field and he didn't have to worry about his hitters, we would talk and we would watch the game. And I remember him saying, I'll never forget it. I was in high school and he said, the average major league fastball is 85 miles an hour. And I couldn't believe that. And I mean, I thought they all threw 100 miles an hour, but at that time, the average major league fastball, at least in his opinion, was 85 miles an hour. So I come from an era where, you know, the last thing you want to do is throw fastballs right down the middle. But today, I mean, now I don't know what the average major league fastball is now, but someone, you know, we get a position player coming to the game in Texas, Nate Eaton. And I mean, he's throwing 93 miles an hour, 95 miles an hour. I mean, you know, guys throwing 85 these days, you know, are outside playing catch in the parking lot before a game. You know, they're not on the field anymore. And so you can get away today with using more of the plate when a guy's throwing 93 to 100 miles an hour. It's not the same missing right down the middle of the plate. They're going to get hurt when they do that, but you're also going to get a lot more foul balls. So there's that. And then I just think too, you know, for some of the pitchers, not all of them, I mean, you don't have to set up down the middle of the plate for Zach Greinke. You probably don't have to set up down the middle of the plate for Jordan Lyles, but for the younger guys who are still getting their legs and don't quite have the precision yet at the major league level, you probably don't want to ask them to try hitting the corners all the time because, you know, if they miss, there's a 50% chance that the hitter's not even going to swing at it and it's going to be a ball and you're behind in the count. Whereas you're aiming for more of the plate and maybe you miss your spot, you might still be in the strike zone. You might get a foul ball. You might get a routine out, whatever. So from that sense, it begins to make sense. But based on what I've been raised with over my life, it's like, don't throw a fastball right down the middle of the plate, but the times are different. And not only, you know, using more of the plate, but just having the catchers move up closer to home plate, the target appears to be bigger. and they're going to get more strikes because it's going to be easier to frame pitches when you're closer to the plate, as opposed to being farther behind. And by the time the catcher receives a pitch down, you know, around his knees, he thinks, well, that's, I mean, if it's down around my knees or lower, that's a ball. But when you're far, when you're way behind the plate, it crossed the front of the plate as a strike, and the catchers don't even try and frame it. So there's an advantage to just being closer to the plate. And so I think some of the strikes that they're getting right now, Kevin, are the result of the catchers being closer, and some of those borderline pitches, once the catcher receives it, in the umpire's mind, it's still in the strike zone.
Okay, the one player I get asked about most, and probably it's the case for you too, and so here we go. I'll just ask you what everybody else is probably asking you, but I don't know how to answer it, other than I know that there's a lot of expectation and an awful lot of pressure on Bobby Witt Jr. to become something other than just a guy that's going to hit 265 with 20 home runs and 70 RBIs or something like that, to be the kind of a guy that's going to carry a team from time to time, or, you know, be the guy that you expect once a week to get that big hit and win a game and do some spectacular things. He struggled again last night on a play in the field. He made a very poor throw a few days ago trying to turn a double play that cost a big run in a game. He's struggling a little bit defensively, and now he's struggling a little bit at the plate. What do you see in his game? Is he pressing? How important is he that he makes another step this year? Just walk me through Bobby Witt Jr. right now.
Yeah, and I enjoyed watching him play last year. I personally don't think he was as bad defensively as some of the metrics would suggest. And I'm just going by the eye test. I mean, sure he made some errors and made some plays that, or some throws that he shouldn't have made and resulted in an error, but I never really felt like he was hurting the team defensively, but that's just my opinion. But the physical talent is just off the charts. But you know, I mean, he's basically a double-A player who is in the big leagues. I mean, he didn't get a whole lot of time at AAA. He's extremely young. Everything has come very, very easy for him. I do think the most important thing that he possesses, and this comes from, you know, being raised by a major league father, whatever's not working for him right now has nothing to do with being overwhelmed by the major leagues. I mean, he just looks like he belongs. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, there's some things that he needs to adjust, or the league is going to continue to exploit him. And right now it's fastballs up in the strike zone, either on the edge of the strike zone or out of the strike zone. And once the league figures that out, these guys have the ability to do that over and over again until he makes the adjustment. And I felt like last year, if you were to ask me, what did I think about Bobby Witt Jr. as a hitter last year? And what was one thing that he can improve? I felt like in most of his at-bats, he swung at least one pitch that was out of the strike zone or shouldn't have swung at. And so everything that he accomplished last year came when he was either behind in the count or even in the count. And so, and even this year, if you look at the numbers within the numbers, one issue that he has is he has had very few at-bats or plate appearances that have ended, or at least we've gotten a final result in a hitter's count. He's almost always hitting in a pitcher's count. So, I still see that this year, you know, and, you know, he'll swing at a high fastball and foul it straight back. And the natural reaction is, you know, he was right on that. And I know fans wonder, what does that mean? That was a great swing on a foul ball, or he just missed it. And usually when a hitter swings and fouls a pitch straight back, that means they had it timed perfectly. Their timing was there. They just didn't make solid contact. And hitting is all about timing. So it's not a matter of his timing. It's just a matter of pitch selection. But, you know, we were talking about this before the game in Texas, and then we all were reminded of how young he is and that he didn't have a long time in the minor leagues to work on this, and he didn't face pitchers like this in the minor leagues. So that's what I see. I don't see it defensively. I think defensively, if anything, he has to understand his range. I thought last year he went after a lot of balls that he probably should have just let go, or he made some throws he should not have made that, you know, it was impressive that he got to certain balls, but that's it. You don't need to make a throw here because the runner is going to be safe and you might throw the ball away. And he did occasionally. I think that that adjustment's going to come more immediate. But I do see this year just the propensity to chase fastballs up in the strike zone, either swing and miss or foul him back, and having more at bats where he's hitting on the pitcher's terms and not on his terms.
So what you're seeing, you think long term he is a shortstop?
Yeah, I do. I mean, he has the arm to be a shortstop. He has the range to be a shortstop, the hands to be a shortstop. And the defensive things that he's going through right now has nothing to do with him playing shortstop. It's just, Denny Matthews says that, every good fielder, and specifically infielders, they have a stopwatch in their head. And when a ball is hit, they know how much time they have to throw a runner out. And, the good ones know, okay, I really have to hurry here because of this guy's speed or the speed of the ground ball or whatever. And then the other ones, they realize, okay, I got to the ball, but I'm not going to be able to throw this guy out. So the best thing I can do is just field it and give it back to the pitcher. And I think that's what he's learning now defensively, is just calibrating his stopwatch. And I think he's been so good his whole life that he thinks he can get to every ball, which is a great trait to have. I mean, he made a great catch the other day, running out into left center field and making a diving play. You don't make that catch unless you immediately think, I can get to that ball. But then you have to balance that with, well, what if I do get to that ball? Then what am I going to do? Am I going to try and make some crazy throw and it ends up in the third row? Or, if I, instead of diving here and getting a glove on it and that's all I do, just let it roll into left field for a base hit and the guy's going to have a single either way. So those are the adjustments he's making, but all the physical skills that he has, I think, says shortstop.
Yeah, I see that too. I see the physical skills. He's just going to have to make the plays, and some guys are just going to boot a certain amount of balls no matter what. And if that's the case, that I'm all on board with this at least this year. Let him do it. Let's see how it improves. Whatever. But my goodness, he could probably be the best center fielder he ever saw if you put him out in center field, wouldn't he? I mean, that's the beauty of having shortstops. You can move them anywhere and they'll be great defenders, but you do have to, at this level, you've got to make every routine play. I mean, you've just got to come up with all of them and make a good throw every time. You just have to.
Right. And it's the one spot in the infield where there's no room for error. Right. I mean, the other three spots can bobble and you can still likely get an out. A shortstop can't. And that's why you put your best player, defensive player on the field, usually ends up at shortstop.
All right, the Royals are deploying a shift. They're bringing the right fielder in on many occasions, and I think they've done this a couple dozen times already. And I've read some stories around baseball that the Royals are the only team that have done this, and they're bringing the right fielder into, every story I read says 240 feet, and I don't know if there's a rule or what you can do with your right fielder or how far you can bring him in, but that seems to be their metric, that if a ball is hit hard, you can throw him out. What is... Not statistically numbers, unless you have them, you can recite them. Does this work? Does this look right to you? This is against left-handed batters that are basically dead pole hitters. We've seen some opportunities. Do you think this is something everybody will wind up doing because Matt Couture and his staff are implementing this?
Yeah. So your first question, does this look right? all of a sudden, remember I'm the 52-year-old now, so it doesn't look right to me, but I know that these guys, they wouldn't do that if, the risk outweighed the reward. And it hasn't hurt them yet. There was a double in San Francisco, but I think Kyle Isbell was playing center field, and he got to the ball and held the hitter to a double, and it would have been a double anyway. You're putting some big gaffes out there. I mean, you get a left-hand batter who slices one up the left field line, and now you're looking at a triple, where it might've been, a single, if you're talking about a guy who doesn't run well. It worked last night for the first time, with, MJ Melendez throwing a guy out from shallow right field. It was Nate Eaton was in right field. So it's worked. And, but I don't know. I mean, but I do know that they wouldn't do it if they didn't feel like the percentages were good. Just like as we were adjusting to the shifts, before the rule change, that just didn't look right. Now Zach was hurt by the shift from a left-hand batter last night, but that shift would not be in place unless Zach signed off on it before the game started, because the reason why shifts ended up being embraced so quickly, and I think this goes back to A.J. Hinch when he was with the Astros. And the year before, the Astros were one of the first teams to go with, you know, the radical shifts, and the pitchers hated it, and you know, the infielders felt like they're out of place. And so they rebelled against it. And then A.J. Hinch became manager, and the first thing he did was sit the pitchers down and show them the data and say, now, what do you think? And so that spread through the game, where pitchers then were part of the decision-making process. They may not have made the final decision, but they're part of the decision-making process. So if you have a shift and the ball beats the shift, well, hey, we discussed this before the game. So you can't throw your glove and be, you know, cursing the fates because this was part of the discussion. And I'm sure that's the case with the pitchers here, and especially, you know, a veteran like Zach. But does it look right? I'm going to have to get used to it.
I think it's a great sign for this coaching staff. You know, the Royals went from being one of the teams that thought maybe didn't embrace a lot of analytics or metrics. And now if they're the only team doing this right now, they've obviously thought of something. They've looked at the new rules and thought, here's something we do that can be used to our advantage against certain hitters. What we know now is with the infield shift being illegal, it's in a very short period of time dramatically changed the game. Singles are way up this year, okay, with no shift. Therefore, scoring is up. The bigger bases have led to more stolen bases, and the pitch clock has led to games that are 32 minutes shorter. Everything they've implemented is working, Ryan. Every single thing. Again, it's not half a season yet, but that's enough baseball games. We got hundreds of games already played. It's working. All of this stuff is working. They knew in advance this was going to work, didn't they?
Well, by being able to use it in the minor leagues, I think they were very confident. And it is working. And I laugh every time I hear someone say, yeah, baseball's a great game. They don't need a pitch clock and they don't need to limit shifts. And usually the people who are saying that, and I'm using that voice symbolically, is it being an old cranky person. And my answer always to the old cranky person is, this is the game you grew up with. There was no pitch clock, but this was the tempo and the pace that they pitched with, and they didn't have shifts all over the place. So it might be more just arguing with the fact that rules are being implemented, but this is the way the game was designed to be played. And it's, I enjoy it. I saw something where the shift was making a difference, but maybe that was the least of the changes that we're seeing right away. And I have a theory on that. And we're noticing that teams, and the Royals are one of these teams, and certainly the teams they've been playing, but teams that are winning, when they win their games, are scoring 6, 7, 8 runs, 9 runs a game. We played the Giants in San Francisco. They had won 3 games and they scored 35 runs. When they're winning, they're scoring a lot of runs, but when they're losing, they're not scoring any runs at all. So, and obviously when you win, you're going to score more than when you lose, but I'm talking about scoring 8 runs a game when you win and a run and a half when you lose. And there's a lot of teams that are going through that right now, like the Rangers who are playing right now. So my theory is that the lack of shifts have improved the game and there are more singles, but I don't think the offenses have adjusted yet. They're still in the lift the ball mindset, big inning mindset, go for the home run and the big hit mindset. And so when that works, you're going to score some runs. But I think over time, teams are going to realize the value of scoring one run in an inning. And I've been screaming about that for years. The thought that a strikeout is really just an out. It's not that big of a deal. And if a guy strikes out 150 to 200 times, well, you know, what's the big deal? It's just an out. And the guy, at least he's swinging hard because he might hit a home run. And my argument has always been, show me the metric, show me the analytical data that proves to me that 0 runs is better than 1. Somebody show me that when you have runners at second and third with 2 outs and you got a guy up there swinging for I-70 and he strikes out instead of, you know, flaring a ball to right field or putting the ball in play and driving in a run. Show me where 0 runs is better than 1. And oftentimes you go back to innings when I look at my scorecard and the game's over, I think we could have scored a run here. We could have scored a run here. Yeah, maybe we didn't get the big hit in the 8th or 9th inning, but what about the 3rd inning? What about the 5th inning? What about the 6th inning? We had a chance to score 1 run. So I think over time with the lack of shifts, the game is going to be into revalue scoring one run, that this may not be an inning where you score two or three runs, but get one run. And so that's why I think you're just seeing such a dramatic disparity in runs scored when a team wins versus when they lose.
Yeah, nobody really watches baseball to see strikeouts. I mean, it's great when your guy is striking their guys out. That's a lot of fun. Like if you're a Rangers fan last night, you know, and Heaney's out there striking out nine in a row, you're feeling pretty good about your team, but nobody really goes to see that. We want action. And I think from that standpoint too, of all the things they're doing in baseball, fewer strikeouts would be a great thing for the game as well. We watch baseball to see the ball batted into play. We want to see great defensive plays. We want to see hits to the gap where somebody fast runs all the way to third base. We want to see all kinds of cool action. That's what people want to see when they watch this sport. I don't think anybody really likes to watch strikeouts.
I love that line. You love strikeouts when your guy's striking, right. Striking the other team out. Yeah. But for the most part, well, I mean, the Royals end up losing 11-2. So what does it matter? But early in the game, you know, very early in the game, the Royals scored a run in the first inning on an error, and they had runners at second and third and one out. And that's when the strikeouts began. That was when the first of nine began. But I mean, that's a situation right there where you got to score another run there. Yeah. You got to get another run in there. But I don't know if the players have fully adjusted to the opportunities that they're out there, the space in the field that's out there now, and have to relearn the art, if you want to call it that. It feels like it's that now, but the art of scoring just one run.
Right. Well, you know, I'd say it even like this on behalf of my pitchers. I'll use a couple Royals pitchers as an example. I've watched Brady Singer strike out the side by throwing 15 pitches in an inning and go, wow, he's got some great stuff today. Look at that. And I've watched Brad Keller when he's on, you know, throw a 5-pitch inning and get 3 ground balls. And one of them is a really good defensive play. And the inning took about 40 seconds. And I go, whoa, he's really dealing. And that was fun to watch. I'd rather watch Brad Keller get 3 ground balls in 6 pitches and 3 outs than watch somebody strike out the side. I really would.
Yeah, I agree. Cause I mean, we all, maybe we're numb to the lack of inaction over the past several years, but I think the game is much more interesting with more action on the field and more players involved.
Yeah, it can be fun. Okay, I want to ask you real quick about a couple of people who you've been around. Not the first one, not all that long. He's Chris Young. He pitched for the Royals in 15. And, you know, I know he got a contract extension, I think, after his first year or something, and then had some injuries and wound up in the bullpen or whatever. Tallest pitcher I ever remember for the Royals. Really smart guy. We all knew this. We remember his story. I can't believe how fast he left as a player, worked for Major League Baseball for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden, 2.5 years ago, becomes general manager of the Texas Rangers. I don't think I've ever remembered seeing anybody climb up a front office that fast. I've seen some guys become managers pretty quickly, but general manager. What do you remember about Chris Young? Is not too long time in Kansas City, but now that he's GM of the Texas Rangers.
Well, he was my last friend who was a player, and may end up being that way for the rest of my career because I keep getting older and they keep getting younger. But he was the last guy that I hung out with away from the field. And when I say hang out, go out to dinner, sometimes it was the two of us and sometimes it might be Scott Sharp or whatever, and just talked about baseball and talked about life. And he's a special person. He has it all. I mean, we know about the Princeton education and, you know, he was a top prospect and then he was injured and, you know, doctors were telling him one thing, but he wasn't really feeling it and believing it. So he did his own research and diagnosed himself with something else. And sure enough, that's what it was. And it got him back to the big leagues and he was comeback pitcher of the year. And then he couldn't get a contract and he ended up with us in spring training. And, you know, I don't know if we win the World Series in 2015 without Chris Young. And just a great guy. So interesting to be around. And he, you know, we say this all the time as an expression and a compliment, you know, he could do anything he wants when he retires. Well, Chris Young could do anything he wanted in the game when his career was over. It was just a matter of him sitting back and deciding what path he wanted to choose because the options were unlimited. And the first thing he did was he got into the commissioner's office. And, you know, he wanted to learn the business of baseball from the owner's side of things, which I think is really smart if you want to be an executive someday, because it's, you know, you're listening to the union banging the drum your entire career, and the owners are the bad guys. And, you know, as we all know, that when you sit down and you look at the facts, I mean, both sides have their motivations, but we need both sides, and we need both sides to succeed for this game to thrive. So he decided to join the commissioner's office. And there was a time, Kevin, where we were thinking, you know what, he's going to be the next commissioner. And I think I don't know if anyone would admit this, but I think that they were grooming him to be the next commissioner, if that's what he wanted to be. I mean, that's how involved that he got in very quickly. I mean, he was one of the masterminds behind the COVID plan in 2020 and the protocols to get us on the field for those 60 games. But he's from the Dallas area, and there was an opportunity for him to, because he was living in New York most of the time and Dallas part of the time when he was in the commissioner's office. And he has three kids and they're fairly young. And I think he probably over time wanted to be home, and he got this opportunity to come back and be a general manager for his hometown team. And now he's armed with the information from the commissioner's office and having a long playing career. And then last year, the president, John Daniels, president of baseball operations, gets fired, and all of a sudden he's the guy. And so, but he's equipped to do it, and he's got the mentality to do it, and he has experience. And I'm assuming the next person you're going to refer to would be Dayton Moore. And they had a great relationship in Kansas City. And I think Dayton is the perfect, I don't know what his exact title is, but advisor to the general manager for someone in Chris Young's position.
I think it's really cool. And I know that it's probably not a completely full-time thing for Dayton Moore. But he obviously is close to Chris Young, as you were. So obviously you guys all have an awful lot in common. I think it's cool that Dayton Moore is doing that. Chris Young, this will be interesting to see what happens here, because they got a lot more money to spend than they would have had in Kansas City. This owner's letting them spend some money in Texas, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of money last year on their shortstop and their second baseman. They spent a lot of money on pitching this past offseason, and they didn't have a very good year pitching. And I think, you know, Chris, I was never in the dugout when he was pitching. I mean, I would just see him before the games and after the games, but I would hear about what a fierce competitor he was and how intense he was. And that kind of stuff does not go away when you take the uniform off and you get a next job. And I think, you know, when Dayton arrived in Kansas City, he was very intense. I mean, he left the Atlanta Braves, and Dayton was the hottest future general manager on the market. I mean, that was a tremendous hire by Mr. Glass to get Dayton, because he had some large market teams that wanted him, but he wasn't interested in going to a team that would just spend their way to a championship. I mean, he came up in player development, and he wanted to be part of something that, if you're going to, let's build this thing from the ground up. And the timing was right, but he was very intense, and he felt the pressure, and we didn't win for a long time after he was here. And over time, I think Dayton really learned what was important, what were the things that he just needed to let somebody else deal with, or just not deal with it at all. He was always very good at delegating, but that just improved over time, where he just gave people underneath him more and more responsibility and built them up, you know, to be leaders. And so that makes him a great asset for Chris Young, because, you know, Chris Young's feeling the pressure big time. I mean, he spent $500 million on a shortstop and a second baseman, or at least the Rangers did two off seasons ago. And then they go out and get Jacob DeGrom and Nathan Eovaldi. I mean, they went out and got some big name pitchers to improve their pitching in a short period of time. So there's a lot of pressure now for that to turn into wins, and to have someone like Dayton by his side to guide him through that and help him manage, you know, the essentials and the non-essentials as far as where he needs to put his attention. But I will say this, Kevin, I don't know how full-time it is for Dayton, but Dayton Moore doesn't do anything part-time.
Okay.
So if he's here doing this with Chris Young, and I haven't stuck my nose in it at all. I saw the both of them in spring training, and you know, they have a job to do, and it was good to just chat with them a couple of times. But I have to think that Dayton is not just a close confidant and a yes man or throwing some ideas out there. I got to think if Chris had to know that if you're going to hire Dayton from a position that he just had, that Dayton's going to be, you know, very involved and not just on the margins. Yeah.
All right, we'll finish with this, a feel-good story, and most Royals fans know the name Mike Gerschle. Managing in Omaha, he won his 1,000th game in Omaha. Who wins 1,000 games as a manager? This guy's been doing this forever. Who's been more involved in player development of this organization than Mike Gerschle? That's quite a deal, and it was emotional. His wife came down. They gave him some flowers after the game. There was a video tribute on the board in Omaha, George Brett, Mike Sweeney, Christian Colon, some others. We saw all these players, and all his players stayed on the field in the dugout. That is a remarkable total, 1,000 wins.
Yeah, and he is so loved in this organization. I mean, and that's a hard job. You know, you say 1,000 wins. I mean, 1,000 wins in the minor league is a lot. 1,000 wins with one affiliate is a lot. And 1,000 wins in AAA, which is, people will say, is the most difficult minor league managerial job, because you have guys, you have a roster full of guys who feel like they should be in the major leagues. You have guys who have been in the major leagues and feel like they should be back up there. You have guys who are on the edge of the major leagues and are just waiting for the call up. And we always hear when a player is called up, how they found out, and, you know, Mike Gerschle brought him in, and that, but you don't hear much about the tension leading up to when they're called up. And you really have to have the right guy who's comfortable in his own skin, who cares about the organization and doesn't get caught up in the emotion that comes with players coming and going at the AAA level. And so he is so respected. He's so loved. And I'm so glad that he got that opportunity to be major league third base coach. And, you know, that's something that Dayton did as well as any general manager that I've seen while he was here, just promoting from within. And, you know, before he was here, there was always a feeling that if we needed to make a change, we had to go get somebody from another organization because what we had wasn't good enough. And so for Gersh to be rewarded for all that time in the minor leagues and get to be the big league third base coach for a while and getting this chance again, I mean, it's just the whole organization is just thrilled. He's one of the most popular, and has been forever, one of the most popular members of the Royals organization.
Yeah, really cool stuff. Ryan, I have once again taken way too much of your time. I cannot thank you enough for joining us. We'll speak from time to time this season. I look forward to talking a little baseball, a little life, maybe some things that happen within the game. We'll see how it goes over the next few weeks and months. It's always a blast catching up with you, man. Thank you. And on behalf of everyone listening to the podcast and Royals fans everywhere that you don't hear from, we really, really, really enjoy your work, and we are glad it's baseball season.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate that, and I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for listening to Kevin Keatsman Has Issues, presented by Roberts Robinson Chevrolet Buick GMC. To get exclusive patrons-only podcasts, receive a weekly newsletter, and attend in-person patrons-only parties, visit kkhasissues.com and become a patron today. This has been a production of Crooked Tail Media Incorporated.